Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hey, guys. I think it's safe to say that even a casual observer of the United States Congress would likely conclude that the atmosphere, the interpersonal atmosphere there, is not awesome, pretty deeply suboptimal. It seems like the two parties are constantly at each other's throat. The personal relationships that reputedly used to exist across the aisle seem to have dissipated, if not just simply disappeared. So this week we're going to take you inside a really interesting experiment that's going on across the pond in the British Parliament. 150 members of Parliament there have taken mindfulness training programs. Many of them also sit regularly in private, confidential groups where they meet across party lines and apparently create real friendships and share some pretty deep stuff. Obviously, this has not created some sort of brigadoon. The whole Brexit situation is clearly pretty choppy, to say the least. But this experiment has apparently made a real difference. So we have two guests this week. One of them is Chris Ruan, who's a member of Parliament from Wales. He's been serving since 1997. He says, and you'll hear him say this, hey, he used to be the kind of guy who would scream and shout on the floor of Parliament. And that he has subsequently, post-meditation, undergone a real personal transformation. So his story is fascinating. The other guest is Jamie Bristow, who runs a think tank that emerged, that grew out of these efforts to teach mindfulness to Parliament. It's called the Mindfulness Initiative, and they research how mindfulness can change public policy and healthcare, incarceration, et cetera, et cetera. So that's coming up. First, a very quick item of business is very quick. I just want to quickly highlight one of our favorite meditations in the 10% Happier app. It's called Training the Mind, or more specifically, Jeff Warren's Training the Mind. Jeff Warren is a very good friend and an amazing meditation teacher. If he was a personal trainer, this meditation session would be kind of his full body workout. He takes you through five mental qualities that he believes are important for a well-rounded meditation practice. If you want to go check that meditation out, you can just click on the link in the show notes. Or if you are a subscriber to the app, just go in the advanced and unguided section of the singles tab. All right, go check that out. Now, though, here's Chris Ruan and Jamie Bristow. You're going to hear us talk about how mindfulness can boost positive relationships and communication in high-stakes adversarial situations, how it can reduce unconscious bias. We talk about the difference, and this is really from Chris when he gets very personal, the difference between living based on intrinsic values versus extrinsic values. So when you're living based on what's meaningful to you as opposed to what's meaningful to the culture or somebody else like your parents. And we talk about whether this kind of mindfulness experiment could be imported here to the U.S., So here we go. Here's Chris Ruan and Jamie Bristow. Nice to see both of you.
Mm-hmm. It's good to be here, Dan.
Let's just start with some biography. I'd be curious to hear how each of you got interested in meditation. And by the way, give me the proper title. How should I address you?
Chris.
Just as simple as that?
Absolutely. I'm Chris Ruan, the Member of Parliament for the Vale of Clwyd, which is in wonderful Wales. I'm a Welsh MP in the United Kingdom Parliament. And I got into meditation, not mindfulness, 32 years ago. I was a primary school teacher for 15 years and then an MP on and off for 22 years. And as a primary school teacher, our school was being inspected by Her Majesty's Inspectorate and the staff got the jitters, they were shaking. So the school principal brought the nurse in and she taught us tension and relaxation throughout the body and to use the breath. And I got so much out of that I wanted to use it with the children in my care. So I started meditating with 48 and 9-year-old children and doing the breath and doing visualizations, and it just worked for me. It worked for them.
Yeah, and you stuck with it over time?
No, I practiced it for about 4 or 5 years with the children, and then I came across mindfulness about 12 years ago when I was helping my daughter, Seren, which is Welsh for star in the sky, with her homework, comparative religions. Came across Buddhism. I didn't realize the centrality of mindfulness meditation to Buddhism. So I downloaded some podcasts from Spirit Rock in California. Actually, some, it ended up to be about 300 podcasts.
Wow, you went deep.
About 12 years ago. And I've listened to them on the journey on the train down to London, 2.5 hours, and on the way back. And
from your district?
From my district.
In Wales?
Yeah.
And we should say Spirit Rock is a venerable meditation retreat center in Marin County.
That's right.
In California.
And Gil Fronsdale was – I mean, they had visiting artists on the podcast, but Gil Fronsdale was the kind of anchor man who I listened to for 6 years and practiced meditations. And I got so much out of it that in 2013 I thought – or 2012, in fact, I thought – Parliament could benefit with this. We'd just come through the expenses scandal, where lots of people were burnt out.
Expenses scandal. We should just say that there were members of Parliament who were basically busted spending government dollars for personal stuff.
Yes, yeah, and some of it illegally, and some, I think, 3 or 4 members of Parliament went to jail, and some of it legally, but. People felt it wasn't moral, so there was a whole review of expenses, and people were still stressed. Like 3 or 4 years later, still stressed now. So I thought I should have introduced it at the time, but about 2 or 3 years afterwards, I thought I'll take it to Parliament, and I contacted Professor Richard Layard, who wrote a wonderful book, Happiness: A New Science, and The Good Childhood. Richard is a professor at the London School of Economics and a Labour Lord. And I knew he was well connected in the well-being world, so I approached him, and he put us in contact with the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, Professor Mark Williams. And Mark came down with a wonderful teacher, Chris Cullen, and we introduced our lessons in January 2013. And over the past six and a half years, 250 parliamentarians and 350 members of their staff have had mindfulness training.
All right, I want to go deep into that, but first, let me just, Jamie, let me get your background real quick.
So I came into this story anyway when I was working at Headspace in 2012.
They're a little-known meditation
little known
app.
Meditation app. Well, they were little-known back in the day anyway.
They're not little-known now. No. We're all of us in the meditation game are standing on your shoulders, figuratively, because you guys were the first meditation app.
Yeah, and then back in those days, there was about 9 people in the organization and 5 desks in a small business center in North London, and now, of course, they have hundreds of staff in California somewhere. So I was let me rewind and just talk about where I got into mindfulness and meditation. First off, so I was lucky enough to come across it when I was in university. So there was a meditation society. So I joined the Ultimate Frisbee Club and the football club and the meditation club.
And by football, you mean soccer.
Oh, I mean soccer, yes. Of course. Proper football.
The real deal.
Yeah. And so just one of those things I picked up and tried and, you know, did it for a few months. And it came and went, and it was just another, you know, experience. And then I graduated. I got into a big creative agency, advertising agency in London, like a global network. I was working too hard, you know, working long hours. And the culture there was like drinking every night and then drinking too much coffee the next day to get over the night before. And surprise, surprise, I couldn't concentrate for the, whatever it is, the crazy 10, 12-hour days I was trying to do. And so I came back to meditation in order to be a better advertiser, in order to focus better. But with that self-regulation benefit that a lot of people come into this stuff for, I also... And then sort of moved on to self-exploration, realized there was kind of more to me and to the world than I originally thought there was. And that led me to really question what I was doing there, whether advertising was right for me, whether advertising was right for the world. And changed my life and ended up in a climate change campaign. So we went from selling Nissans, as I think they're called over here.
Nissan, yes.
Selling 4x4s, and then a few years later, you know, talking about how we desperately need to reduce our carbon emissions for the survival of our society. So that just lit a fire underneath me. Really, that was I realized that mindfulness was what sort of changed my perspective on things. And so I thought, well, maybe if more people knew about this, then they would also sort of be more sensitive to the information that's out there. And change their perspective also. So that led me to, trying to get a job at Headspace, turned up and said, hey, do you want to take me on? That led to being a volunteer with the parliamentary initiative that kicked off in 2014. So the politicians had been already been practicing for a year or so on this 8-week mindfulness course, and they started to become interested in the science behind what they'd been learning and the policy implications in health and education, criminal justice system. And so I was one of 15 to 20 volunteers and experts who showed up to help them to create a cross-party group, an all-party parliamentary group on mindfulness, which is like it's kind of like a student society, actually, for backbench MPs, so those who aren't in government, who to help them come together on an issue of mutual interest to inquire into that area and make recommendations for government. So I was actually enlisted on the criminal justice strand of that inquiry, and we had 8 events in Parliament, 8 hearings over 12 months, and pulled together the Mindful Nation UK report. And so I was just one person on the team there, but then I was asked to take over as director. So I've been running a charity, an education charity, a policy institute, which supports this group of politicians, helping them do what they do.
That's the Mindfulness Initiative.
It's the Mindfulness Initiative,
and we owe
yeah.
a great deal to it, and to Jamie as well. Good man.
So let's go back to the beginning of this mindfulness initiative that you provoked, Chris. What was the reaction from your colleagues, the other MPs, the other members of Parliament? We've had on this show before Tim Ryan, Democrat from Ohio, who's now running for president.
Absolutely.
And he is a very public meditator, and he started what's called the Quiet Time Caucus in the United States Congress. And to my knowledge, he's gotten 0 actual members of Congress to meditate. A lot of staffers, but no. Last time I spoke to him, no members of Congress were publicly talking about this. At least, I think maybe some of them had talked about it, but they weren't doing it with him. Yeah. So anyway, not a huge buy-in. Did people smirk at you when you started talking about meditation within a political context?
Yeah. Initially, yes. But we had 22 members of Parliament and members of the House of Lords, peers, on the first class in January 2013. So there was some buy-in. And I was the recruiting sergeant, and I would pitch it differently to different MPs. MPs that I knew were struggling, I would sit down in the House of Commons tea room with a cup of tea and sit down and talk to them about their issues and say, listen, there's a nice intervention called mindfulness. Come along and see how you feel. Other MPs that weren't perhaps suffering, and I've been very fortunate that I haven't suffered with mental ill health in my life so far. I pitched it as a flourishing activity. Other MPs, perhaps shadow ministers, I would say, look, education is part of your portfolio, part of your brief. Health is, criminal justice. Why don't you come along and see what mindfulness could offer you as a shadow minister? So it was different.
Can you just quickly define what a shadow minister is? We don't have that here.
Yeah, you have a government ministers for 22, I think, different departments of state. You'll have a cabinet member, and then you'll have ministers underneath that cabinet member for that department. And there will be a shadow of that for the opposition. So the opposition, if there's an education secretary of state for education, there'll be a shadow Secretary of State for Education.
Gotcha.
So they shadow each other. So I would
What party are you in?
I'm a Labour MP.
And were you only recruiting from your own party?
No, not at all. We took a cross-party approach, left and right, sometimes extreme left, extreme right, extreme centre MPs and peers would come together. They'd leave the politics at the door, and we'd sit and meditate, sometimes in silence and sometimes guided. And we'd have discussions afterwards, and we'd express our vulnerability in those oak panelled select committee rooms where we delivered our mindfulness practice.
And nobody was leaking information.
Nobody was leaking, and we've had no leak for 6.5 years. And you know, some people have spoken about their alcoholism, their neglect as children. They've fallen vulnerable in front of others from different political parties, and there has been, and I think it's in the expression of that vulnerability that those bonds are strengthened, the bonds of friendship and understanding. And it is beginning to change the dynamic of discourse in Parliament. Tim Lawton, I'm the Labour co-chair, Tim Lawton MP is the Conservative co-chair, And he speaks, what's the terminology he uses?
He says that there's an affinity amongst those who have been on this mindfulness course and a rather more considered approach to exchanges of differing views. In other words, politicians are starting to report that they disagree better and they can have better dialogue.
Mm. Yeah. But it's not all rainbows and unicorns, as I like
to say. No, absolutely. It's not the age of Aquarius, absolutely.
You guys had something called Brexit.
Brexit, and it had something. We've still got it, and we'll be suffering from it for decades to come.
Well, but you can't figure out how to actually do the exit part.
No, absolutely. And it's you know, life's about ups and downs, and political life is about political ups and political downs, and it just feels like we've had a 3-year political down where all we've talked about is Brexit. We've made virtually no progress. And some of those who were in favour of Brexit 3 years ago when we had the referendum said, you know, this will take 5 minutes to do. Once we've voted for it, we'll just sign these papers and Brexit will be there. It'll be one of the easiest acts that we've ever passed. And that hasn't been the case. And there is massive pressure in Parliament, there's massive pressure in the country and even within families, you know, different generation. There's generational differences, and it's. I mean, David Cameron, in giving the British people a referendum, has sown the wind, and we are now reaping the whirlwind. And now more than ever, we need a practice, an intervention that can help us stay balanced in these turbulent times.
Do you think, if you didn't have this, that the Brexit conversations would be even worse?
I think it's still a real minority of people who have been on the course, and particularly those who have really committed to the practice over time.
What would you say the percentages of members of parliament who have done the course?
Well, members of parliament, so the main house that's
been negotiating this.
So there's about 150 members of parliament who have been on the course. Is that right, Chris?
Yes, and about 100 peers from the House of Lords.
And that's out of 600 plus.
No, that's out of 650 MPs. And 700, 800 peers now.
Exactly.
So the numbers sound big. 250
peers are members of the House of Lords.
Peers are members of the House of Lords, yeah. So the numbers sound big, an impressive 250, but that's out of a total population in Parliament of something like 1,400 members of the Lords and members of the Commons.
So we've got this small kind of small group that's starting to say, well, only a few years ago they started to say this could be impactful on political culture. And then they started to say, it has been. I have different relationships. I find that I talk differently to people, different tone, bring other things, bring more of myself into the conversations I have in this house. And then in the last 6 months or 8 months or so, we've actually seen demonstrations of that in the chamber itself. So there was an intervention just before Christmas where Tim Lawton really took the heat out of the room. People were kind of baying for blood almost in the now infamous exchange during Prime Minister's Questions, which is our kind of weekly Punch and Judy question and answer with the Prime Minister. And he just
It's an amazing spectacle, by the way. Before you tell the story about Tim Lawton, for those of you who don't follow British politics, you're forgiven. Except for maybe by the two people I'm talking to right now, but by me, you're forgiven. They do this thing once a week, right, where the Prime Minister comes in and just fields questions from a whole group of the members of Parliament in the House, right there on the floor of the House of Commons. And it's pretty hardcore. It's like a press conference, but, you know, it's from fellow politicians, not journalists. And they're screaming.
Yeah. And the design of the chamber in the House of Commons is it's designed like a bear pit. It's not circular. It's not in an arc. It's directly about 4 or 5 paces away from each other. So and they're banked seats going up 5 or 6 rows, and it is like a bear pit. And you have them.
What's a bear pit?
A bear pit is where they used to pitch two bears to fight against each other.
And you've got the different parties on each side in these banked.
I used to be one of the worst offenders, but.
Really? I have a hard time imagining. So you would scream and shout?
On occasions. And I asked the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom a question about mindfulness in February of this year. I'm not sure if you can get the clip. But I asked the Prime Minister a question, and she answered very knowledgeably about mindfulness. And then the Speaker of the House of Commons, he intervened and said, the Honourable Member used to be very kind of boisterous and loud-mouthed in the chamber, and he has changed his behaviour. So I got a pat on the head from the Speaker of the House of Commons, so it must work.
Okay, so back to Tim Lawton, he's the Conservative co-chair mindfulness.
Yeah, so there's this practice group in Parliament, and then there's also the policy initiative. So we're not kind of assuming that everyone who practices is interested in how this might be applied across society. But some of them are, and so we have this all-party group, which has two co-chairs, Conservative and Labour, to inquire into how this is being applied across society. And that's where I come in.
Okay.
So I don't do the teaching of people in Parliament, but I do the talking about mindfulness in society. So back to parliamentary questions. There was a lot of heat in the chamber, and Tim stood up to ask a question. And his colleagues were going like, "Go on, Timmy, go on," to like ramp it up, basically. And instead, he just took a pause, took a breath, and just said, "Calm," in a really big way. And the whole the fever pitch dropped a few degrees, and then just went on to ask what he wanted to ask about education funding. And it's only these are tiny things, but I think they're like baby steps or green shoots. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't overstate what individual mindfulness practice can do on a group level without some kind of group dialogue about how we want to change the culture together towards something that is more mindful and more considered and more responsive rather than blindly reactive. I hope that will come when more politicians have got that personal understanding. But we've had, in the member of the House of Lords, there was a debate a month or so before that, and we had three different political parties represented where people said there should be more mindfulness in our international relations was the first intervention. Second one was, there should be more mindfulness in the way that we work with the cabinet. And then someone else said that there should be more mindfulness in this house, and gave a really good definition of it and said that we should have more of a mindful approach in the House of Lords. So it's quite recent, this development, where it's becoming part of the public record that politicians are calling for a different type of discourse.
Can you genuinely forecast a near future where you have a much higher level of buy-in and where you do see the kind of behavioral changes on the floor of the houses that you would like to see?
Another tipping point where we've seen recently is around mental health more broadly. And so in the last 4 years, the public discourse around we all have mental health, we should all talk about it, we should all find treatment when we need it, and we've got problems, and we should be doing preventative things to bolster our mental health, has, in the UK at least, shifted a huge amount. And that's because the royal family, the young royals, have come out and campaigned about mental health. We have, grime stars, rappers, we have sportsmen. We have politicians all saying, I've had issues and I'm better now and here. So that's been enormously helpful. It's just shown us how quickly you can have cultural change. And I think we're starting to get kind of critical mass, both in Parliament and in society, because the numbers we're seeing, and this is reflected in the US, I believe, is that the number of people who have meditated is getting towards 15-16% of the population. And if you look at how new technologies and new trends are taken up, that's the kind of point where it jumps into a mainstream conversation.
I mean, I think you have two trends in both countries simultaneously and probably interrelated. You've got, and maybe more than two trends, but you've got a growing embrace of meditation, and you've got record levels of anxiety, depression, suicide. And you've also got this introduction of technology, which does enable the dissemination of meditation, but it is also, on a more pernicious level, enabling people to be more isolated, cut off, stuck in social media cul-de-sacs where they're comparing themselves to other people and feeling, lesser, and et cetera, et cetera. So a lot going on, these sort of interrelated self-reinforcing trends, that some of them negative, but I think the meditation part of it is really riding on some of this, and I think could be a positive force. I'm not Pollyanna about this, but I think it could be positive.
And there's a tsunami of mental ill health that's sweeping the world, and the Western world especially. Jamie and I spoke at the United Nations on Friday, and the UN, or the World Health Organization, says that by 2030, the biggest health burden on the whole of the planet will be depression. Now, not mental health per se, just depression.
Wait, say that again, because that's worth it.
The World Health Organization says that by 2020, depression will be the second biggest health burden on the planet. By 2030, it'll be the biggest health burden on the planet. And at the moment, we are dealing with depression primarily through drugs, through antidepressants, and that's important. And drugs, antidepressants have a role to play. But if you have a look at the consumption of antidepressants, and I've put down written parliamentary questions to health ministers in the United Kingdom, in 1991 in England alone, there were 9 million prescriptions written for antidepressants. Last year, it was 67 million. So there's been a massive uptake in the use of antidepressants in the United Kingdom, and it's the same in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, especially in the Anglo-Saxon world, but other countries as well. So, and we're not, you know, 9 times happier than 1991. Have you taken these?
No.
We're not. If anything, our happiness and our well-being has gone down over that. And I think people are looking for something that's natural, something that's innate, something that's human, and are finding it increasingly in meditation. And Professor Mark Williams, the professor who taught from Oxford University Mindfulness Centre, the man who taught us mindfulness in the House of Commons, he is the one of 3 professors, including Zindel Ziegel from Toronto University and John Teasdale from Cambridge University. In 2004, they produced the science that was accepted by the National Health Service in the United Kingdom for mindfulness to be used for repeat episode depression. So the science in the United Kingdom has been proven and accepted and freely available since 2004. The take-up has been minimal, and we need to look at the reasons for that, the lack of number of...
Take-up, you mean buy-in from regular people?
Buy-in from regular people.
Not so much buy-in from regular people as it's the health services not providing it where they should be. Then there has been changes there in terms of the National Health Service trying to address that. But it's more difficult to set up a mindfulness training program with the quality of training
than to hand out a pill. So just going back to this statistic from the World Health Organization, by the 2030, they think depression will be the biggest health burden on the planet?
Yes.
What do they think is driving that, and what do they think the burden will look like?
I don't know if there's been any scientific analysis as to what is bringing this about. I've got my own theories, and there's a wonderful American sociologist, Robert Putnam, who
Harvard. He wrote a book called Bowling Alone.
Bowling Alone, and he chronicled the decline in community and the rise in atomization and alienation. There is a wonderful British journalist and psychiatrist called Oliver James, who wrote the book Affluenza. Mm-hmm. He maintains that it is advertising that this is the main reason. The purpose of an advert is to make you unhappy with what you've got so that you'll purchase something else to make you happier. There's a whole slew of theories about the impact of social media, mm-hmm. of computers, taking our, with every algorithm, they've got algorithms. Every time we go on the computer and we do a search, they can search deeper and deeper inside an individual's brain to know how we work and sell adverts to that. There's the new theory is the impact of our gut bacteria. It's a fascinating field that our gut is actually the second brain. 90% of our serotonin is produced in our gut, and that bacteria has been damaged over the past 50 or 60 years by processed food, by overuse of antibiotics, and even some say by cesarean sections,
microbiome
that is handed.
I only know that because my wife is an expert.
Absolutely. You know when the baby comes through the birth canal, the baby is given the mother's microbiome. So there's many fascinating theories, but I think this is an area that is worthy of further research. You know, if we're facing this tsunami of mental ill health, we need to know the reasons, because it's all right treating the symptoms with antidepressants or psychological therapies or mindfulness, but we need to get behind what's causing this. And as politicians especially, you know, we shouldn't be sacrificing our kids on the altar of profitability.
I think there's an opportunity for mindfulness training to not just address the symptoms. I think it addresses the causes more deeply in our own lives, but there's an opportunity for it to address the systemic societal context as well. So rather than saying that, let's have a look on this training course about how there are nourishing and depleting things in your life, which is a common component of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which John Kabat-Zinn developed and has had most of the evidence base behind it. So some teachers have already been including the context of people's lives within the container of that environment, sort of bringing it into the inquiry about the causes of distress and happiness and how we can change things to make more of one and less of the other. But there are lots of innovators now looking at how we can actually ramp that up. And as Chris says, that could be really where the more profound shift comes from longer term.
Stay tuned. More of our conversation is on the way after this. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. I was looking through some of your materials before we talked, and one of the you've got a publication coming up. I hope I have this right. It's called Living on Purpose. And it's about, which can, you know, I'm just to my listeners may sound like a little vague, but what does that actually mean? But you're actually talking about, and this is your term, a crisis of values, which I think goes at this whole Putnam theory of bowling alone, community has dissipated, we are kind of atomized individuals stuck in our curated Instagram feeds, looking at other people's curated Instagram feeds, feeling inferior, not having our mirror neurons activated by actual face-to-face communications with other members of Homo sapiens. And a deeper part of this, a previous guest on this podcast has referred to something called junk values, that we're taught this myth of Western individualism, that it's we need to just build up ourselves all the time, and that if we're stuck in this kind of selfing mode, then it's aggravated through what has been referred to as ego itching powder of that's not my term. It's a great term of, again, a previous guest, that we're going to be unhappy. Mm-hmm. And it's because we've been taught these junk values like junk food, and that it appears to me that you're working on what you call a crisis of value. So are we talking about the same thing here?
I think that's Jamie's terminology. Do you want to speak to that, Jamie?
Yeah. So, excuse me.
He's going to clear his throat before he drops some wisdom on us here.
Yeah, are you ready? I might just mention another part of the story here in terms of the mindfulness in politics.
Yeah.
So in 2013, teaching started in the UK Parliament. It also started in a couple of other parliaments, like in Sweden. Then Chris and his colleagues helped launch it in some other places, like the Netherlands. And since then, we've helped politicians to start mindfulness training in about sort of 10 other national legislatures, so France and Ireland and
Iceland.
Iceland.
Haven't cracked the US yet.
Haven't cracked the US.
I want to talk about that, but we'll carry on.
We're waiting for the invite.
It's a separate program.
It's a hard case, so you need to. You need some special machinery.
I think there's some opportunities at state level, and if we get invited to come and speak to the state legislators, then we'd be happy.
You're a shoo-in in California. Beyond that, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. So over the years, we've been visiting these different places. Last year, we went to sort of seven parliaments alone. Back in 2017, we pulled together this international congress of mindful politicians or politicians who practice. And we had 40 from 14 countries, and we had a day and a half led by Jon Kabat-Zinn in Westminster. And it was really interesting in that session how politicians are talking about the role of this in their lives. One Italian MP said that, a member of parliament, said that, one of the issues is that we do things just because there's pressure, and we do things that are out of alignment with what we really want to achieve. Because the momentum and the fierceness of that environment. Another Dutch MP, Esther Ohand, said that she finds that mindfulness helps to stay more in touch with what's most important to her, her values, and act in line with that. And so, and Chris has been talking about this as well, I'm sure Tim and Ryan has, for years. So it was really these anecdotes that made us think, like, what is going on here? Let's drill into this a little bit more deeply. And so, yes, we've spent a year or so at this the organization that I run, which is like a policy institute think tank, researching, interviewing people, and pulling together what we think is a case for mindfulness, not as an isolated or as like a siloed intervention for addiction or for depression or for anxiety, but instead a fundamental capacity that could help us in society be more in tune with what is most important to us, what is going to serve us, and act in line with that. And critically, it comes back to this responding creatively, not reacting blindly, or reacting out of conditioning or habit. There's so much, like, the momentum, the stream of our culture is going in one direction, and many of us are kind of waking up and feeling that that's not right, but it's so difficult to turn against that stream and act in a different way. Mindfulness training, people are reporting, helps them to do that.
And but on this crisis of values thing, mm-hmm. that's kind of stuck out to me. Yeah. What's give me the download on that?
Yeah, so there's an organization in the UK called Common Cause, which looks at how we are motivated by different value sets. So roughly speaking, there's the intrinsic value set and the extrinsic value set. So intrinsic is like I want to invest in community and love and relationships and meaning and purpose and generativity building stuff, and extrinsic values tend to be those things that you were referencing there. So fame, material wealth, and status, and it looks like from the research that these inhibit each other. So the more we boost one, the other goes down. And so advertising potentially is really spent, a lot of dollars are going into boosting the extrinsic value set. However, if you ask people what is most important to you, what do you try and govern your life through, 75% of people will say the intrinsic values are more important to me. That's what I want to live in line with. However, they think that everybody else is extrinsically motivated. So you ask them the same sort of question, how do other people, live their lives, and they say, well, they're all extrinsically motivated, about the same, 75%. So it's kind of like a prisoner's dilemma. It's like, I want these things, but everyone else is out for themselves. We kind of need to have a different conversation about, what it means to be human and what we really want in life. And so the challenge is that it is going in the wrong direction, from my point of view. We are getting more extrinsically motivated over time. So I think we need to have a conversation about and surface what we really want, have a conversation about values, make it explicit, rather than letting the algorithm designers to dictate it for us.
And this is not new. Robert Kennedy was talking about measuring things in monetary terms back in the 1960s, and the two things of value back in the 1960s and now and forever is marriage and family and relationship. And we seem to have lost sight of that, through pursuing materialism. I mean, I've got a 24-year-old daughter, Sarah, now. When she was born and I held her in my hands, I looked at her and I didn't think, I want you to be a chief executive. I want you to be the prime minister of my country. I looked at her and said, I want you to be a happy child, a happy baby and a happy adult. And, you know, we're far from our natures. And this isn't, there was W.H. Auden wrote a poem, I think he got a Nobel Prize for it in 1947, The Age of Anxiety. There was a book written by Treisman, I think, in 1953 called The Lonely Crowd. We're far from our natures, and it's about reconnecting. And for me, mindfulness, you know, you're supposed to say what is your intention every time you go into mindfulness. And for me, it's about connection. It's about connection with myself. It's about connection with the people around me, the ones I love, the ones I'm indifferent to, and the ones I don't like. And it's about connection, indeed, to the planet, without sounding too fluffy, to the universe. You know, I am made of the same stuff as meteors, comets, and stars. And I think sometimes we are so focused downwards on, I've got to have this, I've got to have that, I've got to get here, I've got to get there, that we forget to look upwards and realise, you know, there's big things going on out there. We are a speck on a piece of dust in the cosmos. And I think that appreciation that there are bigger things than ourselves and our egos needs to be felt by individuals, the 7 billion people on this planet, because it's the only way we're going to rescue it.
Three things come to mind listening to you talk. One is there is a quote that I think I used in a book, I don't remember where I got it from, that if you're always looking around, you're never looking up. Or if you're never looking up, you're always looking around.
Yep.
So based on that, I was just going to say there is some research that I can't cite chapter and verse, but that shows that the feeling of awe, A-W-E, yep, can lead to better behavior and happiness. So that the sense, mm-hmm, of being a speck in the cosmos, or there's an incredible picture that's the wallpaper on my home computer, which is called Pale Blue Dot, and it's a picture of Earth from outer space, and all it is a pale blue dot, and we really get a sense of all of our, I think it was Carl Sagan rhapsodizes about this picture, about all of our dramas, everything in human history has played out in what is at best a pale blue dot to most of the rest, yep, of the universe, probably invisible to the rest of it, really. The third thing I want to say, though, is all of this sounds good in theory, but I just think about my own life. I'm a TV newsman. You know, I have to have some public footprint. I have to have a social media profile. I write books. I want them to sell, et cetera, et cetera. So you're a politician. You got to run for re-election.
In a democracy, you have got to say, vote for me.
Yes.
I'm a good that guy. Yeah. Look over here. I'm here. And I raised this issue because it was worrying me for a number of years with Professor Mark Williams. And I said, in a democracy, we have to project ourselves. We have to say, my party's better than that party. I'm a good person in my party. That involves ego. That involves projecting yourself. He said, and it always comes down to this, it's about intention. Why are you doing that? And if it's just about your ego, if it's not about wanting to create a better you, a better community, a better society, a better world, then perhaps your ego is out of control. So it's about intention. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with ego. There's nothing wrong with anger, really. If it's how we direct it for the purpose and the intention of our ego or our anger and many of the other values that we think could be potentially negative.
Do you think it's a politician? I'll go first. I'll say for me as a public figure, my meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, talks about motivation, another word for intention, I think, although the Buddhists are pretty persnickety about language, so there may be some difference in there. But motivation, it runs along a spectrum. So, it's going to be messy. So it's going to run from the high-minded to the crass. Mm-hmm. And so for me, as I think about why I do what I do, why do I have a podcast? Why am I writing more books? Why do I, you know, maniacally go on television, wear makeup and all this other stuff? Why do I give speeches? Why do I do all that? On the high-minded end of it is, you know, I do think it meant, you know, journalism and mindfulness, my two professional pursuits, can be healing forces on the planet. But do I also like money and attention? Yes. And that hasn't gone away just because I've started doing meditation. So I ask you as a politician, has the sort of negative aspects of the ego gone away? Or is your intention purer now after all this meditation?
They're more in balance than, you know, I spoke at the United Nations. When I was 12 years old, I did a project on the United Nations, and I drew a lovely picture of the UN building, and I started my speech on Friday about that. And
so you just spoke at the United Nations?
I just spoke on the United Nations.
You're here in New York because you just spoke at the United Nations.
On Friday, and I introduced my speech with that, and it was – my ego had been stroked. I was drawing this picture 48 years ago, and 48 years later, I'm speaking at the United Nations, and I did feel something special. I can't lie about that. But it's the purpose for which I was there, and that if we can get the United Nations as a representative of 193 countries around the world to explore mindfulness and use it as an intervention to benefit the world, then that for me is a noble cause. I did get a buzz out of it. I can't deny that.
So the buzz is there, and I'll let you jump in a second because Jamie looks like he's going to clear his throat and drop some more whiskey. So the buzz is there. I'm asking these questions for completely self-interested purposes because I'm trying to feel better about my ego. So just to be open. The buzz is there, but it doesn't mean you can't, you know, want the attention or the votes or whatever it is. But it's more in balance with what really matters.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and in politics, you can see, and most people, virtually everybody goes into politics for the right reasons, to improve the world. But you can sometimes think you get taken along by it. And
power is intoxicating.
Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts.
Absolutely, yes.
As Lord Acton said. But sometimes you can see people who've come in as decent people, but they start to go ahead by treading on the heads of their colleagues, and getting the promotion becomes, you know, the great thing. But there's nothing as ex as an ex politician, you know. And one minute you can be up, and I know because I lost my seat in 2015 after 18 years as a member of parliament. I lost my seat. And you can be a prime minister, and then you're gone.
Did you win it back?
I won it back, yes.
Okay.
The prime minister, Theresa May, who had a majority in Parliament, decided that she wanted a bigger majority. She's a Conservative MP, so she called an election to increase the size of the majority. She lost the majority, and I got back in.
So what was that like for you after?
It was amazing.
No, what was it like, the bad part?
The bad part. Well, John Cabot-Zinn in 2012 said to me, he's one of my heroes on the planet.
We should just say who he is because I think most people know who he is, but in listen to this podcast. But he's a former MIT microbiologist who basically invented what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, which allowed meditation to get into boardrooms and locker rooms and prisons and all that because he secularized Buddhist meditation. I think he is – well, he's a friend, so – take this with a grain of salt, but I think he's a historical figure, and this development of MBSR, I think, could be a positive turning point in human relations.
Absolutely, and I think he's worthy of a Nobel Prize for the work that he's done, the pioneering work he's done. And interesting, you should say that. There's a British historian called Toynbee who said, when we look back on the 20th century, the greatest thing that we will see is when Eastern wisdom is being met by Western science, and I think we're living in that moment now. So the point was, the question was, which is a
what skill. Was what was that like? So John Kabat-Zinn said something to you.
So John Kabat-Zinn said to me, I think 2012-13, Chris, a word of advice: work on your parachute before you need to open it. Mm. And I had been working on my parachute for 6 years, and when I lost in 2015, he's such a big-hearted man, he emailed me. He said, Chris, sorry to see you've lost your seat. How are you getting on? And I emailed him back. I said, John, I took your advice. I worked on my parachute. I've opened it, and it works. And it worked for me. In 2015, I thought I'd be thrown completely off balance, and I wasn't. I was absolutely amazed. Of course, I took the knock. A few sleepless nights, but then I got on with my life. If anything, when I look back on that 2 year period when I was out, that gave me a new life, a new lease of life, to visit the Australian Parliament, the French Parliament 3 times, the Irish Parliament, and to help spread mindfulness in those legislatures around the world. You know, that 2 year period is one of the highlights of my life. So, you know, out of badness came good.
Jamie, clear your throat.
I'm tracking back a bit here, but I just wanted to clarify that I wasn't sort of setting up a binary thing between the intrinsic and the extrinsic motivations. So it's not like we have good people and bad people, or we have, you know, selfish people or altruistic people, that we have both of these forces in our lives. It's just that people will select which ones are on the whole more important. And, you know, a lot of great, beautiful things have been done in the name of wanting recognition. It's just that recognition could be for stuff which is positive for the community, positive for society, rather than just look at me, I have more stuff than you.
Yeah, no, that's well said. It's about balance. It's about balance. Let me ask you about the United States. So, as I promised to do this earlier, and I really want to do it, I assume you're both familiar with the fact that we have a Congress here. Otherwise, we would be a colony of yours. And our Congress and our politics generally is quite nasty right now. I find it very disturbing personally as an American, the kind of the level of discourse, both in the polity at large, but also specifically in the Congress. And it's not new. I mean, we've been at each other's throats since the 1776, but it's at another sort of low ebb. And so you look at our Congress. Do you think there's any way you can get a camel's nose under the tent here and get some mindfulness in? And is there any way to do better than my friend Tim Ryan has been able to do?
Well, Tim Ryan wrote a marvelous book called Mindful Nation, which I think has been changed now to Healing Nation.
Healing America.
Right? Healing America. Healing America.
It's his campaign manifesto.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
I think, right?
That book, at the end of each chapter, and it deals with mindfulness in education, mindfulness in health, mindfulness in the prisons. He lists 8 things that the reader could do to promote mindfulness. So I would say, you know, mindfulness doesn't have to come from the top. It doesn't have to come from a parliament or a Congress. It can come from below as well. And I think the very fact that Jamie said 15% of Americans meditate, 35% of them practice yoga, there is a yearning out there, a realization that they as individuals, their families are disconnected, and they want something. So that pressure could come from below. If people were to read Tim's book and act upon that and ask their governor if they will come and sit and meditate with a class of 8- and 9-year-olds and feel some peace. So it doesn't have to come from the top. It could come from state level. It could come from city level. And there are 3 projects now to create mindful cities in the U.S. So it hasn't going to come from those are, Jamie, the 3 cities?
Well, 2 of them aren't public yet.
So oh, sorry.
Yeah, so they recently launched the Flint, Michigan Mindful City.
Flint, Michigan, yes. Yeah, so... Even if I'm gathering, you're telling me, even if the Congress is hopeless, it can happen in many ways.
It can, and maybe if there's a lack of interest from the right in Congress, we can bring over some politicians from other countries.
Oh well, actually, I know people on the right. I don't know if it's public, but I know people on the right who are interested in this stuff. I don't know if it's partisan as much as it is just not wanting to be seen as looking weird or just not being interested full stop. Maybe there's an idea that it's going to reduce your edge. I don't know what it is, but it doesn't appear to have taken hold.
Yeah. But it has in other areas of the globe. And it's just, in some countries, it's been led by the right. If the first parliament to introduce mindfulness practice was the Swedish parliament, and it was led by a wonderful woman called Anne-Marie Broden, who was on the right in Wales. It's being led by Darren Millar, a Conservative Assembly member. You know, these are human gifts that have appealed to across the spectrum. They're in every wisdom tradition that's ever existed, in native practices, you know, the Maoris or the Aborigines or the Native Americans. It's there. It's people can feel it and they want it.
So we're talking about. We kind of made a glancing blow there at partisanship, and that it reminds me of something else I came across in the briefing materials that were given to me before I sat down with you guys, which is that in Wales, a mindfulness course has been developed specifically to help policymakers consider their own objectivity and biases. So I'm really interested in that because I think a lot of what's going on, a lot of what's wrong with our culture here domestically in the U.S., but globally as well, is the otherizing of people based on pigmentation, political beliefs, gender, et cetera, et cetera. So I think if we're trying to engender better behavior, getting people to be okay, understand that they have biases and not so owned by them is a very intriguing idea. So how's it going in Wales?
Well, that's a researcher called Rachel Lilly from Aberystwyth University, and she's been taking top flight Welsh civil servants on a course using mindfulness to spot their bias and to compensate for that bias, so to open their mind and their heart and their soul to make sure that what they're delivering in terms of policy terms has been, as far as possible, their own individual biases has been taken out of that as senior policymakers. Mm. And I've visited Rachel Lilly, myself, and Becca Crane, who's from the Bangor Mindfulness Centre, went to see the Prime Minister of Wales about this, and he's interested. So there's big hope there. And what we hope is that where best practice emerges, whether it be in Wales with civil servants, whether it be with the Marines, mindfulness in the Marines in America, or the American penal system where mindfulness has been introduced, that we can spot this best practice and give it to politicians who practice mindfulness around the world so they can look at the science, the best practice, and roll it out in their own country.
I think the program in Wales offers a bit of hope for the US Congress as well, because we're framing mindfulness training in the context of decision-making, of performance as leaders. So rather than coming in and saying, here's a well-being course, or here's some sort of stillness to help you deal with stuff, it's like, here's how we can all be better politicians and better leaders. So some of the members of parliament in London talk about how mindfulness is really helpful for public speaking, or helpful for getting over an interview that didn't go so well, and sort of forgiving yourself and getting on with the business of the day. And so there are ways in which we can target it to that the job of governance to help frame it in a way that might connect with them.
Some of the other framings or some of the other benefits that have emerged, I think, from your research or qualitative research of talking to the members of parliament is they're better at focusing, given the sort of the amount of briefing papers and tweets and whatever coming their way. Impulse control, kindness, metacognition, meaning, perspective of being aware that they have emotions, therefore they don't have to be so owned by them. So it sounds like the people who are taking this course are getting a lot out of it.
Exactly. And we have those stories now. We can come and sort of tell people, Chris can, tell his colleagues in other countries, look, this is having really, tangible impact on our working lives. One of the things that's just really touched me is how difficult politicians' jobs were. I mean, I didn't get into politics into policy making because it's been a long term ambition. Found myself here because I care so much about widening access to mindfulness training, and I've just been meeting so many politicians, feeling how difficult a role that they have. In the UK, anyway, it's a really sort of toxic relationship between the public and politicians, and so seeing how mindfulness training helps them to deal with just an unbelievable amount of information they have to absorb in order to do their jobs, in order to have that kind of thick skin, has just seeing their humanity and seeing how tough it is has been a really important part of this. The thing amongst those benefits I'd like to pick up on, though, is this idea of metacognition, of having a bit of perspective on our thoughts and emotions. So if we are our ideas, then if that idea is challenged, then we see it as a personal offense and a personal attack. If we can separate ourselves a little bit from that idea, you and I can critique it from a bit of distance. So it's not me you're attacking, it's the idea itself. I think that's one of the kind of the longer term hopes, really, is that we have a bit of maturity around discourse, and that could be the mechanism that underpins this disagreeing better effect, which has been reported.
And John Kabat-Zinn, one of his many lines, he said that man is homo sapien sapien, the man who is aware that he is aware.
I use that line all the time. I don't give him any credit, but I use it all the time.
Well, it may not have been John's.
It's
where I heard it, the first time I ever heard from it. And we should recognize that. What we're saying here, in essence, is this is being about being human, mm-hmm. about being true to our roots.
That's a beautiful place to leave it. Thank you both for doing this. Thank you for behaving. I know you like to yell and scream, so I'm glad that Chris didn't pound the table.
Yeah. As we say in Parliament.
Before we go, we do this thing at the end of the show, which is a plug zone. So just can you list off, if people want to get information on either of you individually or on the work you're doing, where can they go?
So the Mindfulness Initiative has a website where you can find out about the politicians, the all-party group, and about our broader work. And the URL for that is themindfulnessinitiative.org. And you can download the Mindful Nation UK report, our workplace-focused document, Building the Case for Mindfulness in the Workplace, as well as find links to the kind of academic paper that reviews a lot of those benefits that you mentioned that politicians are reporting.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. A pleasure to sit with you.
Yeah, really good. Thank you.
Again, big thanks to Chris and Jamie. I do want to say, just as a quick little fact here, that Chris, he gave out his email address. He contacted me later to say he gave out not the exact right one. So here's the right one if you've got a pen. We'll put this in the show notes too. Ruan C, so that's RUANEC, at parliament.uk. RUANEC at parliament.uk. Always dicey to give your email address out publicly, but I respect him for doing it. That was a fun episode. Let's do some voicemails. Here's number one.
Hey, it's Tim from Leamington, Ontario, Canada. Love the app. Love 10% Happier. Love the podcast. My question specifically is, when I'm meditating and I'm focusing on the breath and I get caught in a train and I keep coming back to the breath, lots of times I'll switch focus to my hands as a focal point, for example, and yeah, just be really concentrating on that, get caught in the train, come back to my hands, get caught in the train, come back to my hands. So my question is just, is that good? Is that all right? Is that proper meditation form? Or should I just, am I cheating when I do it this way? Is it better for me just to come back to my breath? On a side note, love the app, love everything about it. Married, have a 16-year-old that I'm teaching how to drive, and we come back from a stressful driving experience. Neither one of us were very happy, and my wife said, "You know what? You got to switch from meditation. You got to take yoga. You got to get better at this." And it was funny because I walked away smiling to myself, thinking, "This must be working a little bit. I must be 10% better for somebody to be noticing and suggesting something that would make me even better than what I am right now." And regardless, I know that I enjoy it. I know that I feel better. It's part of my habit every morning, and I thank you for it and for talking a little bit about it on Good Morning America. So, a couple plugs to you. Hope you guys are all having a great day. Thanks a lot. Enjoy. Take care. Bye.
Really appreciate it, Tim. Thank you very much. Glad to hear it's working for you. So let me get to your question. Absolutely, it's fine. Using the sensations in your hands as an object of meditation is totally kosher. I have a couple more things to say about it. One is that, and this note comes from Ray Hausman, who is the chief of our coaching unit. I don't know if I'm giving her the right title, but anyway, that's essentially her function. She's the boss of our coaches. Even many users of the app are unaware that we have these coaches who you can text with through your app, and they will answer your questions as long as you want. These are experienced meditators. This is not a chat bot. Experienced meditators who love taking questions from our users, and they will answer any question you have. So Ray's actually going to help me start answering some of these questions, and she's brilliant. So that's good for me and for anybody who listens to me. And her point when she heard you ask this question about focusing on the hands is that over time, you may want to extend that beyond the hands to the whole body, because that can give you a sort of more panoramic awareness of even sort of less sensitive areas of the body where it's harder to feel the sensations, at least at first. And this can just boost your ability to pay attention, especially as you move through the day and subtly painful things in your body can impact your behavior sometimes subconsciously. The other thing I'd like to say is that I think it makes sense to do some switching in meditation between, you know, if you're trying to stay with the breath and you're having trouble with that and you might want to move to your hands or you might want to move to an open awareness. But I would, and this I'm just cribbing from my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who said things like this to me, you might want to be careful of switching too rapidly because that can create a kind of, I don't know, a sense of a lack of orderliness in your meditation. So I think when you do it, you want to be doing it with some kind of in a somewhat stately fashion so that you're not all over the place. But so that's the long answer. The short answer is what you're doing is great. The long answer is that over time, you may want to move beyond the hands and develop awareness all over your body. And just keep an eye on how rapidly you're switching between the breath and the hands slash body. Thanks again, Tim. Really appreciate it. Let's go to the second voicemail.
Hi, Dan. This is Amy from Montana. I have a question regarding decision-making and types of meditation. If you're really struggling with a big life decision, is there a certain type of meditation or a way of meditation that can really help you kind of get in touch with your inner guide or your inner answer? Anything you have to offer would be great. Thanks so much for all you do, Dan. Have a great day.
I do have something to say. As usual, this is stolen from somebody else. That probably makes it better than whatever I would make up. I was talking about this very issue with Joseph Goldstein, who's obviously a big teacher on the 10% Happier app and a big figure in my life. And he mentioned a process that I haven't actually tried that much because I'm a horrible student, clearly, but I would pass it along to you as something you might try, which is that if you've got something you're trying to figure out, a creative issue you're working on or a decision in your life, or if you're trying to discern, in my case, sometimes I was trying to think, like, what are my real motives for an action I'm considering? At the beginning of a meditation, per Joseph, maybe just seed your mind with the question. Why am I about to do this? Should I do this next thing? Seed your mind with the question. But then, and this is tricky, drop the question. You are not, and meditate as you normally would. If you're on your breath, you're watching your breath come in and go out. And every time you get distracted, start again. You are not, this is not a contemplation exercise where you're sitting and mulling over the decision. You are purely just meditating, but you're putting your mind in a meditative space, which is all about endeavoring gently to focus on one thing at a time. And then when you get distracted, kind of in a friendly way, bringing your attention back to whatever it is you're trying to focus on, your breath, the feeling of your hands, whatever. So again, you are not sitting there affirmatively deciding to think about the decision. It's just that you have put it into your mind stream in a general way, and then you go about your meditation. And Joseph's theory is, and I assume this is based on his own personal experience, that doing this may put you into a space where you can make connections that you wouldn't be able to make if you were sort of pacing around actively thinking about something, which, by the way, we're not ruling out. You can and should do that too. But this is another way to kind of put your mind into a different kind of zone that might allow for the emergence of new and different thoughts. The aforementioned Ray Hausman weighed in on this too, that there's – her argument is that there's a real power to not knowing. This, we don't like this feeling of not knowing something. We kind of – we rush to an answer. But if you can sit with that ambiguity, it can lead to, as she says, a deeper discernment. And I agree with that, that if you can be okay with the tension of not knowing and just sit with it for a little while, sometimes an answer will emerge. It may not be the answer you want. It may not happen on your timetable. It may not work at all. But these are all things to play with. So thanks for that question. Two great questions this week. Really appreciate it. Big thanks to all the folks who make this podcast possible. Ryan Kessler, Samuel Johns, Grace Livingston. Mike's working the boards today, Mike D. Big thanks, of course, as always, seriously, to the podcast insiders. Those are the podcast listeners who give us feedback every week. I really love that, and I'm very grateful. And we will be back next Wednesday with another show for you. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.